Get connected with Take Two Radio on Facebook or Twitter at Take Two Radio. For email updates on future shows, follow at Blog Talk Radio. For previous episodes, upcoming guests, and more, visit Take2Radio.com.
And good evening, everyone. Welcome to Take Two Radio. I'm Pam, your host. Joining me today is my trusty co-host, David. David, are you with me?
I am, ma'am. I am. How are you?
I'm in the dark. I can't believe how dark it is right now. I hate these time change things.
I know. Darn that daylight savings time.
Right. But I think pretty much all of us in the U.S. are at this point now. So I hope everyone is enjoying their evening, and thanks for listening in tonight. We do have a special guest with us, and her name is Cheryl Dorsey. She was a sergeant in the LAPD. She worked there for over 20 years, and she's joining us tonight to talk about her autobiography, which is called The Creation of a Manifesto, Black and Blue. And we'll find out more about that book, as well as discuss current topics such as domestic abuse, child abuse, the NFL abuse thing, racial profiling, you know, you name it. We're going to try to fit it all in this hour. So let's go ahead and welcome our guest, Cheryl Dorsey. Thanks for joining us tonight, Cheryl.
Hi, Pam. Thanks for having me. I appreciate you.
You're very welcome. I know you're very, very busy. I mean, you do speaking engagements, and you go on shows and talk about everything, and you've been on Dr. Phil, I mean, and you write. How do you find the time to do all this?
Well, you know, I'm just passionate about sharing what I know about police encounters and keeping people safe out there, and so it's almost like there's not enough hours in the day, really, for me to do what it is that I do.
Isn't that the truth? Isn't that the truth? I would expect you don't sleep very much, but we thank you for what you do to try to keep everybody safe and you know, to get some justice in the world as well.
Yeah, there's so much going on, you know, and the things that I talk about, of course, are not unique to law enforcement, not unique to LAPD. I mean, we see it nationwide in Missouri with Mike Brown. We have a Mike Brown here in Los Angeles, a young man who was killed by LAPD by the name of Kezell Ford. And so there seems to be a plethora of things to talk about.
I know. Just right before the show, I was watching the news, which I honestly don't know why I do sometimes, because it's always like 90% bad news, and they were just talking about some NFL player that took a plea bargain, and he's not going to jail after abusing his child. And I can't help but always wonder why. Why does this happen? Why are they allowed to take a plea bargain?
Well, you know, that's the problem with our judicial system, unfortunately. And if you have someone who doesn't have a prior criminal history, and, of course, he's never been to jail before, so it makes sense for him to go ahead and take that plea deal so that he can avoid that prison time. But really, you know, we really need to revamp the way that we handle criminals, because what's the deterrent? You know, it's not
right.
Always even about color. It's about the haves and the have-nots. And if you've got the financial wherewithal to get a good attorney to get you that good plea deal, then you live to offend again.
Exactly. And you do see that over and over again. And, you know, it's put out there a lot, especially when a famous actor, NFL player, or somebody in the music business gets arrested time and time again and get let off with a slap on the wrist. And it just makes all the rest of us insane when you see, you know, maybe a child, you know, a young teenager getting in trouble for the first time and punishment.
Penalty.
Yeah, right. Because, you know, the parent didn't have the funds to get them a great lawyer.
Right, because they wound up with a public defender whose main job is to get that person in the system by way of copping a plea to something that maybe they didn't even do. But because you are who you are, you accept that. You don't want to roll the dice and go to prison. That's what they scare you with. You don't want to roll the
dice.
So you go ahead and you take that plea deal, and then you wind up, you know, in the system now for something maybe that you didn't even do.
Exactly, exactly. I've seen that happen time and time again as well, and that's within, you know, my own family or friends, you know, that I've seen it, and it's just, it's such a sad thing. We shouldn't have to, you know, worry about something like that. Us as parents, first of all, are trying to help our children. Maybe they made a mistake, you know, maybe they did do it, and hopefully they'll learn from it and move on to become a better adult. But then when you have that sitting there on your record, you know, that can play with their minds for the rest of their life.
Absolutely. And then, of course, you know, you have to forever check that box and say that I'm a convicted whatever.
Yes.
Convicted felon, yes. Convicted criminal, right? And people don't know the nuances as to how you got there. All they know is you put a check mark in that box and now they're looking at you in a way that they would not have looked at you otherwise.
Yes, yes. And so many of the ones out there that have only made one mistake and have to check that box are the ones roaming the streets that can't get a job because of that little check in that box. And I just find that unfair as well, because I think if you have to check that box, that person that is looking to hire you should sit down and discuss the situation.
Right.
And may find that it was something that happened when they were younger and they've moved on and haven't been in trouble for the past 10 years, you know, and they are better adults now and they did learn from their mistakes and they want to make a living and provide for themselves and their families.
Right.
Well, if you wouldn't mind, would you share with our listeners exactly what your book is about?
My book is basically about my journey on the LAPD, and I talk about it from a different perspective because I don't really talk about what it is to be a police officer. I talk about what it is internally, what goes on, you know, when no one's looking, how officers are dealt with by command staff. And what prompted me to write my book was a situation that happened here in California last year in 2013 with a black LAPD officer by the name of Christopher Dorner, who had been fired by LAPD, and he had been trying to clear his name because he had been treated unfairly and discriminated against by the department. That was what he alleged. And he just became very frustrated with that system. And although I don't condone what Christopher Dorner did, which was he wound up murdering four people in his frustration, and but I understand how he was driven to do that thing. And so I wanted to talk about the experiences that I had as a black woman coming on LAPD in 1980 when the department was under a consent decree to hire more women and minorities. And they really, really didn't want anybody on that department that looked like me. And so I went through many of the same things that Christopher Dorner experienced, sexism, racism, reverse racism. And I talk about my experiences, and I do it in a way that the department can't label me as crazy like they did with Christopher Dorner, and they can't say that I'm disgruntled because I'm honorably retired. I spent 20 years on that department. But I just wanted people to understand how you can be pushed to do something that you wouldn't ordinarily think of doing.
Right. Has there been any backlash for your book, or have you gotten more of the officers backing you up?
Well, I certainly do have officers that support me, but they have to do it quietly.
Yeah.
I have people that will tell me personally that, you know, they appreciate that I'm speaking because I'm saying the things that they would like to say but can't say because if they speak the way that I do on the department, it's career suicide. And, again, that's not unique to law enforcement. That's anywhere you work. If you speak about your employer in a way that's displeasing, it could be problems if you try to promote within that institution. And so I do have officers that support me. In terms of a backlash, I personally am not aware of it. And so when I speak the way that I do is I always say to the LAPD that I don't want to be involved in any solo car accidents, you know, because I don't trust LAPD. And so I want people to know that there could be a price for me speaking this way, but I'm doing it anyway because someone has to. And so I just put it out there and say, if I get involved in a solo car accident, my driving record is impeccable. Please investigate that.
Yeah, definitely got to watch your back.
Mm-hmm. Right. But I think it's so important that I really share with people, you know, what goes on for real within the police department. Like I said, to help people understand the process, because this is not unique to LAPD. If you work for any large institution, certainly there are times when you may feel like you've exhausted all personnel grievance procedures and policies that are available to you, and you still don't get that resolution. And so what I want readers to take away from my book is that hold on, because life gets better. There's life after that superpower, whether it's a police department, it might be IBM, it could be a large corporation, it could be a school district. Go through that process, hold on, life will get better. And I'm proof of that because here I am, 14 years after I've retired. It's taken me this long to be able to speak on it, but I'm here to speak on it now.
Well, let's discuss some of the issues that we see in our news today, and that is, you know, like I brought up with the NFL, why do you think that some cases are being spoken about more now than before?
You know, in terms of the domestic violence thing, I of course, it's always been around. And the problem that I have with that is that, you know, it's so easy to second-guess someone when you haven't walked in their shoes. And it's very easy to believe that no one would put up with that. I was a victim of domestic violence. I happened to go through it when I was on the LAPD and I was married to a police officer. And because I was a sergeant of police married to a police officer, the powers that be found it hard to believe that I could be a victim of domestic violence. They didn't look at it like I'm just Cheryl and my husband when we go home. I'm not sergeant police officer. And so that same dynamic works, you know, in all genres. And so it's very, depending on the female involved, you know, we stay for all kinds of reasons. And it's easy for someone else to second guess why that person might stay and want to think that maybe they're exaggerating or overinflating the situation. But I just think now we're hearing more and more about it because it's titillating and it's salacious when you talk about celebrity and when you talk about pro athlete, you know? It's like if it bleeds, it leads, right, on the news. And so when you hear about an NFL player or a basketball player who's involved in domestic abuse, well, they're human. They're no different than anybody else.
Exactly.
But
in your case, they would think that you could handle it.
Well, yeah, I mean, I had a male white board because I got sent to an administrative hearing being the victim of domestic violence, which is a whole other story. But, you know, they thought because I'm a sergeant, I should have been able to compel my husband, who was a police officer, give him a direct order and make him behave. And I'm like, are you kidding me? I'm married to a man who could care less about the stripes on my sleeve when I get home.
Right?
So, you know, we had that whole, because, you know, we have a public face, right, and we have a private face. All of us do. And so the way that I comport myself at work when I'm Sergeant Dorsey is quite different from the way that I handle myself when I'm at home. And so it was and then you had the whole, you know, because he was a police officer, I mean, you know, you had the drawing of the lines and people taking sides, and it was just crazy.
Yes, well, I can just picture that in my head as you're saying it, too. You know, those that have worked with your husband, I'm not sure if he's your ex-husband, but some that have worked with him, and, of course, they're going to take his side. Oh, I've never seen him do anything like that. She's crazy. And then there's going to be people on your side. Now, did you find that more women officers were backing you up on that?
Well, I don't know, you know, who was backing me and who was backing them, because, you know, people don't really talk to you about it. All I know is that I almost lost my job because the department found out that there was domestic violence going on in my home. They prosecuted administratively my husband, and then they also went after me. So we had this dynamic where we both were facing the real probability of losing our ability to earn an income. So, and at that time, we're not married anymore, but at that time, we were still married and living in the same household. So it was very it was very contentious, to say the least.
Oh, my gosh, I can imagine.
And yeah, everybody, you know, guns, right?
Yeah, you have to split the house down the center, too, to, you know, keep away from each other during that time.
Well, you know what? I learned to be a very good actress, and so I did what I had to do. And I mean, LAPD prepared me for that because I had to be an actress on the department to get through that process. So I had become accustomed to putting up one face and, you know, maybe thinking something else.
Right, exactly. Now, when did you decide that you wanted to be in law enforcement? What drew you to it?
Well, I was working for a Department of Justice back in the early 80s, and I had been exposed to law enforcement because I was working in a secretarial pool for the special agents in DOJ, and I saw what they did, and it seemed very exciting, and they were making good money, and I was a newly married mom. I had a young son, and I just thought, wow, this is really great. I could, you know, make this a career, good income, get a great pension at the end of it, and so that's kind of what piqued my interest. I was purely motivated by the finances. I never wanted to be the police. I really didn't even like the police, but I needed a good paying job because I had responsibilities and I like to shop. So that was what motivated me.
Oh my gosh, it's funny because, you know, that's what a lot of us do these days. We take jobs, you know, because of the pay to be able to, you know, take care of our families and that. So I can understand that.
Right.
And but they do say that the police don't make much money, so.
Well, you know what? There's overtime, and then there's, you know, you can make a lot of money working overtime. And then there's the prestige, right, because LAPD back then, and even now, you know, we enjoy a certain amount of infamy, if you will, by saying that I'm a Los Angeles Police Department sergeant. You know, not everybody doesn't like the police. So, right. You know, with that, you know, there are some perks. And then when I came on in 1980, I came on at a time where you could actually retire in 20 years with a service pension, which means I get a paycheck for the rest of my life. I came on at 22, and that was very appealing to me because I felt like I can do 20 years, retire very young, and have a second career or not. But I like the idea of being able to retire in my early 40s.
Yeah, I was going to say, you definitely don't look old. I mean, when some people think of people retiring, you know, you have to be 65, 70 years old these days to be able to do that. So,
right.
You know, you're a beautiful young woman, and yet you've been through so much in your life, and it's just astounding that, you know, you can be so positive about it yet.
Well, you know, when I was going through all of that stuff, Pam, on LAPD, I didn't realize then, of course, I understand now that I needed to go through that so that I could speak the way that I do today credibly. Because had I not experienced those things, I really couldn't talk about it. But because I lived the life that I did for 20 years on LAPD, I can tell you exactly how the police department works. I can talk to you about police culture. I can talk to you about surviving police encounters in a way where nobody can refute what I'm saying, not legitimately.
Right, right. That's very true. David, I think you had a question.
Yes. Cheryl, how is racial profiling done?
Say that again. How is racial profiling?
Yeah. How is racial profiling done? What's the process of it?
Well, I don't know that there's a formal process, but I think what happens is because police officers come from society, and so they come onto the department with any department with biases and opinions and beliefs. And then if you're coupled with a partner who also may be a little jaded, then you start to emulate that thing that you see in the car with you every day, and you start to assume, which is what I had become accustomed to hearing white officers ask black men when they would stop them, are you on parole or probation? Because they think that every black man is either on parole or probation or you just got off parole or probation. Well, we know factually that that's not the case. And so if you come with a set of biases and you see that small segment of society that are routinely involved in criminal activity, then you start to broad brush blanket everyone as that thing. And then you start treating everybody that way. And I think over time, some officers, if you're not careful, will become jaded, you will become desensitized, and you will dehumanize people. And when you objectify someone, it's very easy then to mistreat them.
Now, do you think that most of the officers that are that way have that way of thinking before joining the police force, and then it's just enforced more as they're on there from working that job?
You know, I can't speak on that because I don't know what someone brings to the table when they join the police department, but I do believe that the department will create you in a way works for them. And so I don't think, by and large, people become police officers because they want to abuse people. I don't think, you know, you find officers who are just looking wholesale to exert their authority over someone. But I think what happens is that you see what works and you see what doesn't work, and then you kind of get molded into a thing. And if you aren't mm-hmm. careful, and if you don't fight it, if you don't decide that I don't want to be that person, if you don't model good behavior, rather you model bad behavior, then before you know it, you have this vicious cycle, because now you're responsible for training new recruits, and then you show them that bad behavior. And if it's a weak person, then they will model it.
Right, right. Yeah, that's understandable. That makes sense. Now, you know, we're all raised to believe that law enforcement are to be trusted from a very young age. You know, you see somebody doing something bad, you tell your child, you see that, you know, let us know and we'll call the police. If you're being, you know, abused by somebody, let us know, we'll call the police. And, I mean, that's always the first things out of your mouth. If a person is being arrested and they're being abused by a police officer, or even after the arrest, and there's no witnesses to speak of, how does that person prove it?
Here's what I suggest that anyone does if they feel like they're being unfairly or unreasonably treated. I suggest that you just be a good witness for yourself, because what I say is that you will not win if you try to hold court curbside, because police officers have tremendous power. And I refer to a thing called contempt of cop. And what I mean by that is that if you piss me off, then there's a price to pay. And we've seen it happen time and time again. That price could be a traffic ticket, or that price could be, in the case of Mike Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, death, or it could be, in the case of Eric Garner in New York, death, or it could be, in the case of Ezell Ford in Los Angeles, death. All of those instances, I think, are situations where officers were overzealous. They took it personal when the person didn't do something that they ordered them to do, and then they did this unthinkable thing, which is murder them. And so I believe if you are a victim of that overzealous officer, you need to just keep your mouth shut, be observant, get their name, get their badge number, get the information off their car, be a good witness, and then create a paper trail. Because once you create a paper trail, then the department, the powers that be on that agency, cannot act as though this thing never occurred. And it may not benefit you individually. It may take two or three people complaining, but at some point they're going to have to look at this errant officer and say, well, wait a minute, we've had three different people who don't seem to know one another all saying the same thing. Is this a case of where there's smoke, there's fire? So I encourage you to be a good witness, create a paper trail, and write a letter to everybody who has an interest in that officer's behavior, so that one person can't look the other way.
Yeah, that's good advice. That's real good advice. I mean, if there's no witnesses, you're the only witness, and you're the only one that can be there to, you know, try to prove your case. So,
right.
And it's sad that it has to come to that as well. David, go ahead with your question.
Let's see. Do you find that if someone kills an officer, makes the police overzealous when confronting the killer?
I think it would depend on the officer, obviously. I can't speak wholesale for any one person. I think what happens, and not so much in a deadly force situation, but I think what happens with officers is that when you see a pursuit, sometimes, if you've ever seen these things on television where you have officers who chase a suspect in a car for, you know, any amount of time, and what happens is, of course, you get amped up and adrenaline is running through your body, and then when you finally catch this guy, you know, you're angry now because he's had you drive recklessly for however many minutes you've been chasing him, and then you have like a pack mentality, because everybody gets out of the car and everybody wants a piece of this person. I'm sure you've probably seen stuff happen like that on TV. And so
right.
I don't know that, again, officers go into that situation with that mindset. I think it's just what happens. I think it's kind of human nature. And unless you have a strong individual in that pack who can say, hey, hold up, that's enough, stop it, you know, don't need to hit him again, you know, unless you have a strong person, then the pack just takes over, and then it's just a mob. Mm-hmm. And
right.
then they just act like any other mob. They just happen to be a mob of people who are in uniform and have a gun.
Right, right. One thing I just really, really don't understand is these criminals that have been killed by the police when they don't have a gun or, you know, a knife or something on them, and then yet some of them don't. I don't understand that. Is there any insight that you can give us on that?
Well, you know, what I kind of picture happening is that there seems to be a phenomenon all of a sudden, and we hear it a lot lately nationwide, where police officers, and this is not wholesale police officers, this is just that select few that seem to have a problem with relating to minorities, people who are unlike them, where now all of a sudden the officers are saying, that person scared me. I didn't see their hands, or they were reaching for their waistband in a way that was, you know, frightening to me, which is, because if you're the police and you're that scared, then I'm thinking you should probably go call the police.
Right.
But that's what they say now all of a sudden, right? That's what we hear. The person did something that scared me. And, you know, I know that you're aware. I just did a blog where I talk about, I make a comparison between the Eric Preen, the man who was just recently taken into custody after the 48-day manhunt, versus Christopher Dorner, which is the black LAPD officer that also was chased and hunted for 9 days here in California. But unfortunately, he was killed. And so I'm just amazed right now that I haven't heard anybody articulate that they were afraid of Eric Preen. You know, this white man had pipe bombs. He had AK-47
right, yeah.
and all sorts of ammunition that he was spreading hither and yon during this 48-day manhunt, and they see him, and they just simply yell out, "Hey, Eric, I need you to lay down, get on your face," and then they handcuff him. I don't understand how that works.
I don't either. It just makes me sick to hear things like that. You know, a criminal is a criminal. It doesn't matter who they are, where they come from, what color their skin is, what they believe in. You did something wrong, that's it. We're going to take care of it the same way, you know, I would say 99% of the time, depending on the case. But it just, I wish that something could be done about this. And maybe with people like you speaking about it in different ways, you know, through your book and speaking engagements and going on Dr. Phil and that, maybe, you know, eventually things will come around. But as anything else, things take a lot of time, and it takes more than one person. But without one person speaking about it, it's not going to do anything.
Right, and that's part of why I speak so passionately about the things that I speak about. Not that I'm anti-police, but because I really, truly want to make a difference. I started off talking about Christopher Dorner because our police chief said he never wanted there to be another Christopher Dorner. He never wanted a police officer to feel the way that Christopher Dorner felt that would cause him to act out. And I bought that. I believed him initially until he showed me who he really was. And so now I speak out because I really don't ever want anyone, a police officer, a firefighter, a high school student, to feel so helpless and hopeless in your situation, whatever that is, that you would strike out and hurt another person. And so unless and until that institution is willing to admit that there's a problem, we have officers who either are desensitized, who need some psychological reevaluation. We need to figure out where their head is. Unless and until the department is willing to do that, we're going to always have Eric Garner, Michael Brown, Ezell Ford, and others throughout the nation that are murdered by state-sponsored police officers who kill.
Yeah. I just think that as officers, especially when you're in so many years in law enforcement and, as you said, become desensitized because you see this on a regular basis, maybe there should be some program, and maybe there is that I don't know of, but some program that they can get therapy on a regular basis to, you know, check and see where their mind frame is and help them out with that.
Well, you know, I'm not aware of anything here on LAPD, and that's all that I can speak about, but I certainly, every chance I get to say it, I really think that police officers should go through some kind of a reevaluation about every 3 years.
Yeah.
and just see, just take the temperature and see how they're feeling, see what they're thinking. Because when you let someone go 8, 9, 10, 12, 15 years, and then all of a sudden they do this thing, and then you act like you're surprised, you know,
right.
You had no idea. But, yeah, you did, because there were red flags all along the way. You chose to ignore them. But I really think what happens is that police chiefs and police commissioners, they are so singularly focused on protecting that entity, that agency, protecting the LAPD, protecting the city of Los Angeles from civil liability, that they can't, and they refuse to admit when they have an officer who does something that's inappropriate. They just won't admit it because it's easier to act like it didn't happen. And if they have to settle out of court, they'll settle out of court. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, definitely. And I can just picture somebody, 'cause I've seen it on TV, and you always wonder if it's true in life. You know, when you're watching a police show and say somebody has shot some, you know, a cop has shot somebody for the first time, and then they're
right.
brought in to go through therapy, and then they sit there and tell the therapist, it didn't bother me. You know, I had to do what I had to do. It was him or me. And then you wonder, but does that guy go home, and is it really bothering him? Is he having nightmares? Is he acting out in front of his family or to his family or, you know, those around him or even to himself?
Right. And then you have the whole macho thing, right? Because,
yeah.
have a term here in L.A., you know, big city motor cop, big city police officer. You don't want to admit, you know, because you don't want your peers, you know, to think that you're not, you know, a bad boy, you know, you're not a hard ass, if you will, like they are, right? And so I'm not bothered by this, you know, it didn't faze me. If you're human and you care, you have to be bothered when you see someone lose their life. If you're human
right.
and you care, you have to be bothered when you roll up on a victim who's just been shot and they're holding their intestines in their hands. How could you not
right.
be bothered by that?
Exactly. I'm bothered by it just watching it on TV. I can't even imagine what you guys went through, you know, just seeing it in person in real life. I mean, my gosh.
I know. Me too. I am. I'm really sensitive to that. I mean, I know.
Especially when it comes to kids, too.
Yes. Especially kids.
And, you know, for me, I think the reason that I feel like I stayed grounded is because first, okay, so I didn't bleed blue. I say that all the time. You know, I told you, I came on this job because I needed a good job. So
right.
I didn't buy into the system. And, you know, I'm a mother. I'm a mother first. And I always treated people as I would want someone to treat any one of my children if they came across them. And so even though I had a job to do, and if you're acting up and you're breaking the law, I got to take you to jail. But I can take you to jail with your dignity. I don't have to belittle you. I don't have to be condescending. I'm going to take you to jail. I'm going to be professional, and I'm going to let you have your dignity. And
right,
that goes a
right.
long way. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah, and that works in other jobs, too. I mean, we're talking way back when I was like 16, and I had started a job, you know, at a hot dog stand, and I wasn't doing something correctly, but then again, I wasn't shown how to do it. And my boss, you know, berated me in front of everybody. Well, why would I want to work for you? You know, I'm going to leave. That's it. I'm done. You know, that's just uncalled for. You need to do that stuff privately and act
right.
like a professional.
And, you know,
and
some of the stressors that police officers encounter that I talk about, you know, it does come from our supervisors. Some of this stuff, a lot of this stuff is top down. So don't think like, you know, the things that we do or the things that police officers do is because they just, you know, pulled it out of the air. You know, we have
right.
command staff and supervisors who are treating us poorly. And so
right.
it just
exactly.
kind of rolls downhill. It just
yeah.
kind of rolls downhill.
Yeah. Yeah, and when you are in law enforcement, if you're having a bad personal day, you surely can't take that to work with you.
Well, and if you do, you know, you take it out into the field. It's not like you can say, I'm having a bad moment. Can I work the stock room, right?
Right.
That's true. That is true.
I don't want to deal with the public today. You know, put me
yeah.
in the stock room. I'll do inventory.
Right.
So
maybe there should be something like
car,
that.
Yeah, you get in your car, and then the first person that you cross, you let them have it because you're having a bad day, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, that's not a good thing. Now, I wanted to ask you about, you know, child discipline, because as a mother of four, although my kids are grown now, I went through the phases when they were younger, especially with my last son, my fourth child. He happens to be a special needs child. So even at a young age, after he learned in kindergarten, like if somebody does something bad, you call 911, or if your mom's in, you know, choking, you call 911, or that kind of thing. Or if you tell them, you know, smack them on their hand because they're touching the electrical cord for the 15th time, and they threaten to call 911 on you. How do parents handle this type of thing when the authorities come to them?
Well, you know, you have to be very careful because, you know, certainly children are savvy, a lot more savvy now than certainly I was when I was, you know, between, say, 9 and 15. Calling the police on my parents never entered my mind. But, you know, one thing people really have to understand, and this isn't even for children, I mean, this is anybody, what you really need to know is that once you involve authorities in your life, it is almost impossible to get them out. And so be sure and be very sure when you call the police on a child or when you call the police on a spouse. Because if you're not really in it to win it, once you ring that bell, you've lost control over that situation. And then you don't get to say, oh, never mind, officer, we were just having, you know, a disagreement. I talk about something that happened very recently in the news in Oklahoma. A man by the name of Luis Rodriguez was at the theater with his family. And I believe the way the story was reported is that his wife and the daughter got into something. And I think somebody slapped somebody and the police were called. And the police were there to handle this situation between the mother and the daughter. I don't know what caused them to hone in on Luis Rodriguez, but they did. And at some point, the mother began to question the officers who were now antagonizing her husband. She started recording it on her cell phone. And the long and the short of it is that for some reason they wound up wrestling this man down to the ground, piling on top of him, and they killed him.
Oh, God.
Oh, wow.
They killed him. And it just was reported in the news that the coroner just came back and ruled his death a homicide. Now, I'm certain when whichever it was that called, the mother, the daughter, I don't know who generated that call to the police, but I promise you when they called the police, they weren't expecting them to come and kill the father.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, my gosh. Oh, my gosh. You know, that was
but
just
uncalled. But that's what happens. That's what can happen when you get the police involved in your familial situation because you don't know who's going to be on the other end of that radio call when you make it and you ask for help. You hope that you get an officer who's professional, who's polite, who's kind, who's compassionate, who's caring. But if you wind up with a fool, it's a problem.
Right, right. David, do you have a question?
Yes. When there is physical abuse, do you arrest them even if the person being abused doesn't want to press any charges?
Are you talking about in a domestic violence situation?
Right.
Yes.
Yeah, because what happens is, at least here in California, and I would imagine it's the same nationwide, domestic violence is a felony. And so what that means is having that classification means that I, as a police officer, am able to make that arrest. And I don't need you to agree because now it's the state of California. It's the people versus so-and-so in regards to that crime. So I don't need you to agree. That's why I said be very careful, be very sure. Because once you call me out to investigate that thing, if you say, oh, never mind, you know, I was just having a moment, I was a little emotional, it's too late. Especially if I see things that substantiate the elements of that crime, if it's, you know, a family member and I see bruises and that person is still there, I've got the elements of a domestic violence, assault with a deadly weapon, whatever it is, as a police officer, I can arrest, and I don't need you to agree. It would be nice, but it's not required.
Yeah, and I'm for one, personally, I'm very happy that the laws have changed that way, because I grew up with physical and mental abuse from my father, who was an alcoholic. So did my siblings and my mother, too. Of course, my mother got the brunt of it. But in those days, the police wouldn't do anything about it because they said it was between the husband and wife. I mean, how horrendous was that for the spouse and the children to go through for all those years before the laws changed?
Right, because now we understand the cycle of violence. We understand what that means, and we understand that there's a honeymoon period after that initial thing that, you know, causes everybody to, you know, that causes the physical violence. And so we understand that there's a real cycle, and that sometimes when the police get there, they've already moved through, you know, phase one and two, and they've already made it to the honeymoon stage. And so that's why you don't necessarily need the victim to concur, agree, desire prosecution. Police officers can, for their safety, go ahead and make that arrest.
Well, as I said, I'm happy that that's changed. There's so many people out there now that are being saved because of that, even if they didn't realize that that's what they wanted. when they are, you know, prosecuted, the abuser is prosecuted, is there somebody that within the system will help the abusee? I mean, as far as like telling them where to go for therapy and stuff, or do you know if a judge would order something like that? I'm not sure how that works.
Well, I think before it even gets to that, most police departments have an association with shelters and agencies who will help women and men that are in a battered situation, and will provide you a place to go if you need a safe place. And so I would imagine that most every police department has someone that they can liaison with to get that person out of that environment if they so choose to do.
Okay. Yeah, that's good. It's just up to that person to take that under their direction and go and get that help. It's not something that most of them will do, but hopefully more of them will do. Especially when it's just happened for the first time. Like, oh, well, my husband only hit me for the first time. He was really mad. I don't think that'll ever happen again. And they'll just brush it off. What they don't realize is that's just the beginning.
By the time they hit you, it's already been a few pushes and shoves, right? Nobody ever starts off punching you.
Right, right.
You know,
you've got it.
Like we saw in the elevator, right, with the football player in the elevator where he knocks his wife cold out. That couldn't have been the first time.
No, absolutely not. Absolutely not. And it would even starts with verbal abuse, mental abuse,
right,
before it goes to the physical.
Right.
So, yes, I know of that all too well. Now, another thing, you worked for the gang unit, CRASH, which is Community Resources Against Street Hoodlums. Could you tell us more about that? Because, again, that's a very prevalent subject in our society today.
Oh, very much.
Well, you know, when I worked the gang detail, we were having a real situation in Los Angeles in the early 80s, mid-80s, with constant drive-by shootings and homicides between the warring gangs. And so, you know, having grown up in that environment, not in that environment, I was never a gang member, but certainly I grew up in South Central Los Angeles, and so I was not unfamiliar with that. It was an opportunity for me. It's considered a coveted assignment, and so it was an opportunity for me to maybe try to reach, you know, a young person. Because, again, I'm a mother first. I'm a mother first. Everything I do, I'm a mother first. And so those young people that I could talk to and maybe have a word with on it, because I see the same people every day. You know, I work in this area, in this community, I see the same people every day. And every now and then, you like to hope and think that maybe you might say something that would resonate with a young person that might make them think about the path that they're on. If not, you know, long-term, certainly just in the moment, right? Get them in the house for the day to keep them from being outside for the next drive-by. So it was a very, very busy time for us in South Central when I was working the gang detail.
Now, I live in Chicago, and I'm sure you hear about how much crime we have, especially when it comes to being gang-related, you know, on the news and that, because I don't think that's something that's just aired on Chicago news alone. And it just seems to be getting worse and worse. And unfortunately, there's so many innocent people, including children, that are, you know, being shot due to these crossfires of gang shootings. Is crash something that is in every police force, but maybe go by a different name?
I'm not certain about other police departments. I would imagine that they probably have a unit of officers that would deal with this specific type of crime. They may call it something differently. And how that moves and how that works, I don't really know. I know that there are divisions and units within the LAPD that other departments try to model themselves after, like SWAT, for instance, because, you know, LAPD started SWAT, and, you know, we used to go, our officers would go around and probably still do teach people all over the country, globally even, you know, SWAT, special weapons and tactics. Training. And so I would imagine that there are probably some departments who may model their gang unit after LAPD or have something that looks like that. Now, how they work and, you know, are they really motivated? Do they really care? You know, that's a whole other thing, right? It just depends on who's working that unit, because just because you have a unit doesn't mean that the people that are in it may be the best people to be in that unit.
Right.
Do they have a vested interest in the community?
Yeah, and that's why I wonder if Chicago has something like that. I know that they have something put together. Exactly what it is, I have no idea. Excuse me. You know, you'll hear about the mayor talking about it on the news and that, but it seems to be getting worse with the gang shootings and the violence instead of better, or maybe it's just because I'm hearing it on the news more often. How do people within the community fight this? How do they fight against the gangs? How do they get control? I know they do a lot of protesting, and they'll hook up with their churches and go out and do things with their pastors or reverends and whoever they are and do that, but that's not really going to stop it or try to even get it under control.
You know, I don't know that really that's so much a police problem as it is a societal problem, right? Because if the young people, you know, have a lot of time on their hands, if there's no employment, if there's, you know, there's no outlet, if there's no activities, you know, certainly, you know, in some parts of South Central Los Angeles, you know, there isn't even a movie theater, right? So,
mm-hmm.
I mean, if the young people don't have anything to do to occupy themselves, and then if you don't have parents who are absentee because maybe, you know, everybody's working two and three jobs because the economy is what it is. And so you've got kids who are latchkey, right? They're at home alone.
Right.
And, you know, maybe they think the parents don't care. They're easily led. I mean, there's so many variables. There's so many things and reasons why one child may get involved with the gang versus, you know, someone else may not. Sometimes people do it because of. And then sometimes people stay away from gangs in spite of their circumstances and the economics of their environment. It just really depends on a whole variety of issues, I think, and I think it's more, it has to do with society as opposed to just a department.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, because there are rich kids out there, you know, they grew up with everything that'll join a gang, and it's something about, and I think part of that may be because they say, like I've seen on Dr. Phil, that gang is their family. That gang is there to watch their back. They're going to take care of them. They're there for them. And they may feel that their parents and their family, extended family, are not.
And, you know, just speaking as a parent right now, I think really children want boundaries, right? And so
yeah.
If you're not there to set those boundaries for your children, because being in a gang doesn't mean you just get to do what you want, because they have rules and protocols, and they have a ranking structure. They have boundaries within
right.
that gang. There's stuff you can and cannot do. And so it just depends on, you know, really how involved I think the parents are. I think it starts at home first. How involved are you in your child's life? Do you know their friends? Do you know where they are? Do you know where they're hanging out?
That's very true, and if you ask any of my kids, they'll tell you that I'm way too nosy, and they're grown.
My kids tell me the same. Yeah, they always say, "Mom, you're doing too much. You're doing too much." Whatever.
Yeah, I know some of their friends have said to them over the years, God, your mom's always calling you, she's always texting you, she's always out looking for you when you're not home on time. Well, heck, I grew up in Chicago. I grew up with the gangs. I grew up with an alcoholic father. I grew up with the abuse. I'm not doing this because I'm nosy. I'm out there to protect you.
Right.
Absolutely.
Right. And they were always amazed when I could find out things that they had done because I talk to other people. I find out people who know people who know people.
Right. Well, they forget, you know, that we used to be 13, 14, 15.
Right?
Right? Yeah. So even though you think this is the first time that's been done, I've either done it or seen it myself.
Exactly. And they always roll their eyes at you, and they think you're making up stories. But, you know, it's not
right.
necessarily true. I mean, what we speak 99% of the time is the truth. And, you know, when they were growing up, I used to have them sit in front of the TV when there was something on about teenagers abusing teenagers, you know, boyfriend and girlfriend type of thing, and teach my boys, this is not what you do. And I teach my daughter, because I only have one daughter, you know, this is what you do if somebody is doing it to you. You never hide it from your parents or the, you know, the police. You tell them about it. So
right.
I think I did pretty much everything I can. So it's just now as them as adults, they have to remember that and, you know, live their life the way that they should be and hopefully have a safe, happy, healthy life.
Right.
So we are coming up on the hour. I want to let people know, our listeners know, how they can find you and your book. And, you know, do you do speaking engagements for the public, or is this something you do within law enforcement?
I will speak to anyone who is interested in surviving police encounters. That's what I do. So, yes, I certainly do. And you can reach me through my website, which is CherylDorsey.net, and I spell Cheryl with a C. My book, The Creation of a Manifesto, Black and Blue, is available on Amazon. And then you can follow me on Twitter. My Twitter handle is RETLAPDSergeant. SGT for Sergeant. I'm on Facebook. I'm on Instagram. I'm all over.
You're pretty much all over. Yes, you are, my dear.
Yes, you are.
And now I just added one more hat. I'll just share this with your listeners. I started blogging, and so you can find my blogs on Huffington Post. So,
just by putting in your name?
Yeah, you can put in my name. I blog for Huffington Post, and so I'm sharing, you know, things that come up nationally in terms of, you know, various headlines or whatever that I want to speak about from a police officer's perspective and just tell you what I think about it, what I think went right, what I think went wrong, what I think could be done differently. You know, that's kind of what I do. I'm just trying to educate people and just really keep you safe.
Yeah. Well, again, I thank you for that. We really appreciate it. There should be more people out there like you. And
yes.
I know that there are, but we need more. So And I think that, you know, doing speaking engagements at schools is very important as well. Do you do that as too?
I speak to students, especially college students, anyone that's interested in law enforcement, or just anyone who... any group that might have family members that are in law enforcement and you just want to really know what their day is like, you know, I just tell you for real, what it's like to be a police officer to help you either cope with that as an officer, help you cope with that family member, or help you survive that encounter the next time you're stopped by an overzealous, errant officer.
Wonderful. Well, thank you again, and thank you for taking the time out to join us today and share your stories with us. We really appreciate it. And I would say, God bless you. Keep it up.
Yes.
And we're behind you.
Thank you, Pam,
we are.
And David, I appreciate you giving me an opportunity to speak.
You're very welcome. Now go relax for a little while, okay?
I won't tell you what I'm going to go do, but I will relax.
Okay. That's a deal. That's a deal.
Okay. You guys have a good evening.
Take care. You too.
Bye-bye.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Oh, my gosh. What a wonderful, wonderful woman she is. I mean, not just to share, you know, what she's done and went through, but to also go out on these speaking engagements and educate people and society as a whole. She's definitely earned her wings.
Oh, yes, she has. And there should be so much more of these women coming out front just like her.
Yeah, men and women both.
Men and women both.
Well, if you think about it, there's a lot of times men won't listen to women. So if it comes from a man's perspective, you know, they may listen to it more. True.
And it's true. That's because, you know, I think it's the old, what do they call that, the old boys club?
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
More or less, because it says, oh, what, women are just followers, they're not leaders. That's a lot of malarkey. I'm sorry.
Thank you.
We got.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I couldn't agree more. Well, thank you to Cheryl for joining us again today, and thank you to our listeners who have joined us again tonight. I hope that it's helped you out, and if you're in a situation, don't be afraid to reach out to law enforcement. Not all of them are bad. I would say that the majority, 99.9% of them, are there to help you. So never be afraid to do that. And again, if you're interested in getting Cheryl's book, it's an autobiographical book called The Creation of Manifesto Black and Blue. Be sure to get that on Amazon and read her blogs. Follow her on Twitter. Again, that's RETLAPDSGT. So that stands for Retired LAPD Sergeant. And go to her website, CherylDorsey.net. Her last name is spelled DORSEY. Her Facebook page is facebook.com/IamCherylDorsey. And, you know, give her a shout-out. I'm sure she'll help you out. If you want her to speak somewhere, I'm sure she'll do that. I don't know what her schedule's like. It sounds like it's very full, but I know she'll make time for it. Right? And thanks, David, for joining me again today. You wanted to give a special birthday shout-out?
Yes, I would like to say happy birthday, Shirley. Thank you for listening to us.
Yes, I hope you have a wonderful, wonderful birthday. You're always here for us. You always listen to the shows, and we really appreciate it. So God bless you. Have a great birthday. Thank you, everyone, for joining us again tonight, and we'll talk again soon. Don't forget to check out take2radio.com with the number 2 to see where our upcoming guests are. You can listen to the previous podcast there if you missed anything or if you want to listen again or if you want to share it with somebody. If you have a guest that you'd like to see on our show, you know, you can always email me at take2radio@gmail.com, and we'll try our best to get them on. So thanks again. Thanks, David. Have a good night. We'll talk again soon.
We'll talk later. Yep. Good night, everyone, and be safe.
Definitely. Bye-bye.
Get connected with Take 2 Radio on Facebook or Twitter at Take 2 Radio. For email updates on future shows, follow at Blog Talk Radio. For previous episodes, upcoming guests, and more, visit take2radio.com.